You're listening to the winning literary show, Off the Shelf Books Talk Radio, live with host Denise Turney, author of the books Long Walk Up, Portia, Love Pour Over Me, Spiral, Love Has Many Faces, and Rosetta's Great Hope. Turn up your dial and get ready for a blast of feature author interviews, 411 on book festivals, writing conferences, and so much more. Ready? Let's go.
If you believe it will work out, you'll see opportunities. If you believe it won't, you will see obstacles. And that's from Wayne Dyer. Good morning, good morning. Happy Saturday to you, December the 14th. I want to thank our listeners, those of you, our loyal listeners, been with us for over 14 years. And if this is your first time tuning in to Off the Shelf, thank you for joining us this morning. We have an insightful and talented author who has great advertising and marketing experience for our listeners who are writers themselves that we will introduce to you in just a few moments here on Off the Shelf. And we're excited and can't wait to introduce this morning's guest. But before we begin, I'm asking you, how good of a mystery sleuth are you? Do you love mystery? You know, those mystery shows. I was a huge Columbo fan. And then there are other mystery shows that you just want to know who did it, why they did it, what was the motive, how did they do it. If you love mystery, I really encourage you to get a copy of Love Pour Over Me. But even more, if you value relationships, there's a soulmate relationship in the book, and it is a powerful soulmate relationship that is very believable as you see the ups and downs that this relationship goes over through decades. But there's a complicated father-son relationship. I love the friendship that these five guys have who meet at a college in Pennsylvania. But one of them, or maybe more, is involved in a murder. So I encourage you, if you love mystery, you value relationships, to get a copy of Love Pour Over Me. It's an ebook and in print format. If you don't see it on the shelf, just ask the clerk for it. You can get it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Walmart, et cetera, et cetera. If you don't sit on the shelves, you can ask the clerk to order you a copy of Love Pour Over Me by Denise Turney. So please go out and treat yourself to a copy of Love Pour Over Me and let me know how you enjoy the book. And now let us go and meet our very special off-the-shelf guest. And our special off-the-shelf guest this morning is Ned Barnett. Now, Ned is a marketing, remember I told you guys, he's a marketing, advertising, and public relations innovator. He has published more than 25 nonfiction books, including State of the Art in Hospital Advertising and Hospital Marketing Step by Step. He has spoken at healthcare events, and that's a hot topic. That is, I mean, because the costs around healthcare are just getting out of control. But he has spoken at healthcare events and served as a marketing, public relations, and writing adjunct professor at four colleges. Ned has appeared on the History Channel and in the New York Times, Time Magazine, and Newsweek. His fiction and other nonfiction writing focuses mainly on military exploits. Among those novels are Bloody Skies Over Bloody Ridge. First, I'm seeing Sylvester Stallone pop up in my mind. Who drew first blood? But Bloody Skies Over Bloody Ridge, First Shot in Lafayette, We Are Here. You can discover more about Ned at BarnettMarkham.com, and that's BarnettMarcom.com, and I'll spell that again, BarnettMarcom.com. And, of course, you can learn more about Ned by listening to this off-the-shelf interview. We are honored to have Ned Barnett join us on Off-the-Shelf Books Talk Radio this morning. Welcome to Off-the-Shelf, Ned.
Well, thank you very much. What a wonderful introduction. I really appreciate it.
We are excited to have you here. I always learn a lot when I'm researching for the guest interviews, and then even more as the guests share, as they respond to the questions here on Off the Shelf. So the first few questions, Ned, that I'm going to ask you, I ask every guest on the show, and I say this often, I used to just go right into the questions, and then I got a feedback from listeners who said, could you just give us a little backstory on a guest before you go into the question? So every guest gets asked similar to these questions, first about four questions I'm going to ask you. So to kick it off, Ned, if you could tell off-the-shelf listeners, where you grew up and what life was like for you growing up.
Okay, sure. I grew up in a lot of different places. I was originally from Ohio, and we moved we in the Cleveland area, and then we moved to Illinois for a while. But the whole family moved down to Georgia, and that's where I grew up. And I lived and worked in the South until I moved out here to Las Vegas about 30 years ago. My family's still there. My kids and grandkids are there. And that's where my heart is. And I try to show that in some of my writing as well.
How? What part of Ohio? Because I'm from Dayton. What part of Ohio?
Oh, okay.
Curious.
Cleveland. Suburban Cleveland.
Okay.
But I know Dayton.
And it's probably...
I'm an aviation fanatic, so I've been to the museum there. Yeah, and it's a beautiful town. Beautiful. I absolutely loved it.
Now, what did you dream of becoming when you were a kid?
Actually, I wanted to be a writer. Well, first of all, I wanted to be a pilot, but my eyes are not very good, so that kind of ruled that out. I had been appointed to the Naval Academy and failed the eye test. I volunteered for the Air Force and failed the eye test, that kind of thing. But I always wanted to be a writer. And, it's been a blessing to me that I've been able to be a writer, in public relations and advertising and marketing. You do a lot of writing. So I did a lot of that, but it also allowed me time and direction to write my books. And so far I've had 39 books published.
And congratulations to you on 39 books. I'm one of those slow writers. Today, a lot of writers will knock a book out in a couple of months. I just keep working on it, working on the same story, and eventually I come out with another one. But kudos to you. I was going to ask you next, how old were you when you knew you wanted to be a writer? So you were, what, 5, 7? How old were you when you knew this is what I want to do? And you know what? Interesting, when you depending on your response to how old you were when you knew you wanted to be a writer, what attracted you to writing?
Well, two interesting questions. The first time I knew I wanted to be writing was when I was in the summer before the third grade, when I created a neighborhood newspaper and distributed it in my neighborhood. I had to type each one. This was before word processing, and I had a kid's typewriter. I didn't have a real typewriter. It was a laborious process, but I wrote up a newsletter and distributed it. I've always wanted to be able to share information. The reason I was a professor at 4 different schools, believe me, an adjunct professor, you don't do it for the money. You've got to love to help people. And I try in all my writings, whether it's nonfiction or fiction, to help people with their lives to gain insights that will help them in their own journeys. And in the public relations field, what I do is I help writers, primarily because those are my clients, fulfill their own dreams. I help them, as a book editor, if that's what they need, book designer, stuff like that, to create the book, but then I take and help them promote it and market it so they get sales and that they can achieve their dreams through their writing. So it's all part and parcel of the same thing for me.
Ah, now how did you get started? You do have to do a lot of writing, although now it's probably changed quite a bit since you started with your public relations, marketing, and advertising. Now there's a lot of video involved. There's always been audio, but maybe less print because even now we went from print books to e-books, and now I'm hearing that audio books are really gaining a lot of traction now. But how did you get started when you first started out? How did you get started with public relations, marketing, and advertising? Did you start working with newspapers, a local magazine? How did you get your foot in the door?
Well, that's interesting. When I got to college, I had taken some advanced placement tests and wound up being put in advanced placement French, and I had no business being there. I'm very good at taking tests, and I look for patterns. I don't intentionally do it, but I look for patterns. So I scored very high on my French aptitude achievement test, and yet I was awful at French. Really never could get a handle on it. And so by midterm, on first quarter of my freshman year, I was looking to fail the class. I had to get out of it. There was only one major open to me that did not require a foreign language, and that was journalism. So I changed my major to journalism, dropped the French class, and then decided I really liked this. So I went on and took every writing course they had available to us, and actually got published while I was still in college. I still have a photo of the first check I ever got from a publisher for $80, which was, that was huge. That was more than 10% of what it cost me for a quarter in college. So I was excited about that. And that was, I think, in 1972.
Wow.
But I took all the writing courses. When I got out of school, I got a PR job, but I also worked for a newspaper, a magazine. I did a radio talk show, and I was a TV news cameraman on the weekends for a local TV station. So I had a chance to communicate in a lot of different ways before settling primarily on public relations. And I guess the first book that I wrote that was published was about what I did in the field of public relations, which was hospital public relations. And so I wrote a couple of books on that and about other aspects of hospital marketing and public relations when it was all very brand new. It really just gotten started at that time. So it gave me an opportunity to write 10 books quickly and make a fair amount of money. My bestseller at that time was, I made $113,000 from it, which was, you know, at a time when I was making 24 grand a year, that was really good money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's not bad money now,
Ned. No, it's not. But it was really great then. And, but I quickly found that while I'm very good at writing nonfiction, my real passion is fiction. I love to create things. A lot of the books that I write are ghostwritten books for clients, helping them to get their story told. They have a story, but they're not good at writing it themselves. So I help them out. And so I think about 17 of my books were ghostwritten for different clients.
Wow.
And my most recent book was one where I took a client's doctoral dissertation. He had gotten a doctorate of divinity, and I turned it into a book. And believe me, it's a long reach from a doctoral dissertation to a book that people might want to buy and read. So that was a big challenge, but it was an interesting one. And the subject matter kind of was close to my heart. It's about how mega churches are doing things that would help other churches in their own journeys, or even businesses, that businesses could learn from mega churches. I'm not confident that many businessmen are going to read a book based on what churches do, just because that's not how they see things making
right.
sense. But it's all there if they want it, and it'll be published early in 2020.
Okay, and what's the title of that book? And then I want to ask you another question around your start into the marketing, advertising, public. What was that? What's the title of that book where the churches and the business owners, leaders might be able to find some benefit in reading the book?
You know, the title is still in play. Typically, the title's the last thing that I come up with. And my client, the named author, is currently considering several different titles, but it'll be about business lessons from mega churches, something along that line.
Okay.
Straightforward.
Okay.
Nothing cute or fancy, because it's a very pragmatic and useful book.
Okay. Was it easier? Again, I'm going back to when you first started your career in the 70s. Was it easier to get started, get your foot in the door in the marketing, advertising, public relations space back then?
Absolutely.
Was it just as competitive? It was easier?
It was, It was not. I graduated from college during the recession, and 80% of the people in my graduating class took jobs outside of the PR or journalism field. They were just glad to get a job. But I held out. I enrolled in graduate school. So if people ask me, what are you doing now? I'd say I'm in graduate school, but I'm really would like to move out and get a job. I didn't want to seem like I was just unemployed. And I held out, and about 4 months after I graduated, I was able to get a job in the PR field. And that was probably the smartest decision I had made in my career up to that time, is to not assume that I couldn't go there just because, you know, the business market was so bad. So I hung in there. I did what I wanted to do and managed to get a good entry-level job in which I was writing two magazines for an insurance company, one for the in-house employees, another for the field people. And I had to churn out a lot of copy every month. And so it kept me busy. I went from college to writing 8 hours a day every day. And what a great experience that was.
Now, what drove the marketing and advertising fields? And I definitely want to get around to your books, but was it radio? Was it newspaper? What drove it? It's so different now. What drove it? What was the major resource that you used to get the message out about the clients you supported? Radio was much bigger back then. It's television is very, very small now as well.
Right, and that's important. That's an important question. At the time, and for the people I was working with, newspaper was the biggest, most obvious media, and I learned how to get coverage in newspapers, how they worked, what they wanted, and how to give it to them. But live radio interviews, like we're doing right now, were the most effective. The problem was in those days that without the internet, if you didn't hear the radio show, it was gone.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
But now the show will be saved, the URL will be there. And whenever people want to learn about what we're talking about today, they can click on that and go to it. That makes radio much more flexible. And, of course, today there's internet radio as well as radio. But I like the intimacy of a one-on-one that you get in radio or in television. And I've done a fair amount of television as well. But right now, the biggest impact you're going to get is on the internet. The problem and the challenge is to get heard on the internet. It's very difficult. So I developed a way for myself and for my clients to get heard, to create what I call a virtual platform, which is, a platform is what authors are supposed to have. These are the people that they can connect with on social media. And the idea being that by connecting with them, they're going to do what you ask. Well, unfortunately, I've got several thousand Facebook friends or followers or whatever they call them, but I only know maybe 50 of them. The rest are just people who said, can I follow you? And I said, yes. Or I asked them, can I follow you? And they say yes, and then they follow me. But we don't know each other, which means if I ask them to do something, the odds of them doing it are pretty small. They've got no buy-in. They've got no reason to want to help me. Some will, but most won't. However, if you go to a Facebook group that is topically based around what your book is about, you find people that have already bought in on the topic. They're interested not in you, but in the topic. And if you then go there and use your social media skills to get known, become known to that group of people, which is not that hard, then when you're ready to go, you're going to have a base of people that will follow you. I'll give you, for instance, right before the show, I did a search, and I searched Facebook for the top 10 for mystery writers, murder mystery kind of topics. And the first 10 that came up, not the biggest one, not the most important one, just the first 10 that came up, would reach 39,800 people. That's huge. And I'm going to assume there's some overlap there because people are, if they're interested in the topic, they're going to join more than one. So let's just say that's really 20,000 different people. If you get half of 1% to do what you ask them to do, which is to say buy your book, you've just sold 100 books. And you can keep repeating that, and it doesn't have to be limited to 10 groups. I just use that as a for instance. I have in my database over 100 groups that are on Facebook about murder mysteries, because I've got a client who's a mystery writer, and my next novel is going to be a murder mystery. So I'm interested in that. And that's why I chose that group. But I've got groups for you know, Christian authors, for murder mystery, for romance writers, for nonfiction, all kinds of things. And I can go in and create awareness for myself and my clients, and eventually for my book, using it. And every writer ought to do that. They don't, and I'm surprised they don't, but every writer ought to.
Okay. See, that's that marketing. There's
yes,
that marketing
ma'am.
Coming in. Now, how did hospitals, what made hospitals come to you, or did you go out to them and start marketing with hospitals? That's not a field, as somebody who's done some marketing, that I would even think I would have thought about. How did that relationship come about?
Okay, at the time, I was working for a community college in Columbia, South Carolina, as their PR director. And I had some issues with the senior management and thought I might be happier somewhere else. So I started looking around, and I had made contact with all the hospitals in the town because we were going to build a healthcare campus. We were kind of like a two-year college that prepared people for real work, not just liberal arts things. So we were a feeder more to like a Clemson or a Georgia Tech than we were for a University of South Carolina kind of education. And our deal was if one hospital would build a campus for us, we would staff it with our faculty and our students, and they'd get free labor. The big county hospital in Columbia decided to do that, but the one out in the suburban county, they didn't do that, but they liked me. So they offered me a freelance position to help promote a conference that they were doing. And I got it front page newspaper coverage and some other things, and they sold out their conference far more than they expected. So they offered me a job. And this was at a time the Supreme Court had just ruled that doctors and other professionals could market and advertise. Up until that time, it was considered unethical to run an ad or even do a PR campaign. Well, hospitals had always followed the rules the doctors had, because many hospitals were founded by doctors. Not so much anymore, but at the time that was a very common path. A doctor would create his own hospital. So I came into the field at a time when it was all brand new. So at my hospital, we became the first one in South Carolina to advertise, first on radio and then on television. And it caused something of a dust-up. A lot of other hospitals felt that it was unethical, even though the coach had said it wasn't. But that kind of publicity helped to reinforce what we were doing with the radio. And I got started in it because my new hospital, they'd opened a lot of new beds, thought that they'd get more patients, and then they could afford to pay me my salary. Only that didn't happen. And so I'd been there, I don't know, about 6 weeks, and the president of the hospital came to me and says, I'm sorry, we're not, you know, we thought build it and they will come, but it didn't happen. So we're going to have to let you go. I said, well, how long do I have? He says, I can give you a month. I said, what's my budget? He said, I can give you $1,000. So I put together a very low budget radio ad campaign. But it was so successful that our hospital occupancy went up 6%. Which equated to another $1.2 million to our bottom line. So I kept my job. I mean, that's why I did it. Was, you know,
I had a
fire note and a pregnant wife. I wanted to keep that job. But that's what got me started in it, and I was very successful with that because I understood advertising. At the time, I was working on my master's in advertising at the University of South Carolina, and I understood what went on in advertising. So I was able to use it. And a lot of the hospitals tried to compete with me, but they didn't understand the strategy. They just thought, oh, they're here advertising, it works. Theirs didn't work, mine did, because I knew what I was doing. And so it's the right place at the right time.
Wow. Oh, my goodness. You definitely went in to the right field. I was getting ready to ask you what inspired you to write hospital marketing step by step. And how long had you been in the marketing and advertising field before you were in this situation? You got a wife expecting, you got a month, you got to make some work, you got a $1,000 budget. How long had you been working in this field to know what would work? Because radio doesn't always work. But
I had been working about 5 years in the field. I graduated in 73 and it took place in 78. So I didn't have a great deal of experience, but I had a great deal of good experience. What I learned was effective. And the reason I chose advertising and radio was because there are certain radio programs where people just listen, and that's drive time radio, because they want to get the traffic reports, or they want to stay awake while they're driving to work. You know, the coffee hasn't kicked in yet, so they want to do that. So I picked drive time, and what I did, rather than write out commercials that they could then read, I gave them talking points, because the two disc jockeys that I went with, the morning drive time jocks, they were used to talking to people. They did interviews and things like that, and I thought they'd do better telling my story for me than if I just give it to them as a script. So I gave them talking points, and I came up with 12 different reasons why people might want to come to our hospital. One was because we were a brand-new hospital, and we had all private rooms. Well, private rooms was a big deal. All the other hospitals in town were semi-private, so that gave us a marketing advantage. And I did things like that. And what happened, and this was just luck. I did not know this. I'd love to take credit for it, but I didn't. Both of these men were married to women who were registered nurses who worked at my hospital. So I'd pay for a 30-second ad, and they would talk maybe 90 seconds or 2 minutes about what was going on in the hospital that they had picked up from their wife. And their wives were happy where they worked. So it was always good stuff. And it was like, this is fantastic. You know, sometimes just luck of the draw, things work out better than expected. So I got really good endorsement advertisements from these people that thousands of people in the community were used to listening to, because they listened to them every morning when they drove to work. So that's how I got into advertising. And, hey, at least I was smart enough to recognize how lucky I was. But that then help other people come up with their own ways of advertising. For whatever you're advertising for, you got to have the right message. You got to have the right audience, everything. So I've done a lot of different things. And what I do in advertising, I do in marketing and in public relations. You know, in the field, we say PR is what you pray for, and advertising is what you pay for. And while I love to do successful advertisements, I prefer to do successful PR because I have to actually win the news media over so they want to talk about it. Which, you know, advertising, you're paying them for the time and giving them the message, and there's no creativity there, not as much.
Now, can you tell us, before we start talking about your novels, if you can tell us about hospital marketing step by step, what are some of the key topics that you address in the book?
Okay, well, this book was produced, and it came out in two massive three-ring binders, and what people got was two chapters per month for a year, and one chapter would be on a marketing technique, like how to use television. The other one would be on how to market a specific service like the emergency room or labor and delivery, something like that. So we talk about the product side of things and also the process side of things. And this was when marketing was just starting out. So each chapter started very basic on whatever the topic was. And then over a period of 20 or 30 very large pages, they learned more about the process or more about the product and how to market it. And what we did was determine that the target was hospital assistant administrators who had just been told that now they had to do marketing too, but they had never studied marketing. They had no idea what it was. So it was a primer for them to help them with that. And we also determined that these people typically had a purchase authorization of $500, which means they could buy something for up to $500 and not have to ask anybody's permission. It was in their span of authority. So we priced the book at $497. And we printed up 1,000 and we sold 1,000. And then we did another test run for another 1,000 and we sold those too. So it was, you know, it was a book that sold out 2 press runs, and the price was so high that the royalties were very attractive. And, you know, and that were the books that I, that was the most expensive, no, second most expensive book I wrote and the most successful one to me. One book I wrote was about, it was for Wall Street on a profile of the 5 largest for-profit hospital companies, which was something that was brand new at the time. And that one sold for $1,200 a piece, but these were stockbrokers that were buying it to help them figure out how to make money for their clients. So they were willing to pay that kind of money because it was a business expense. It didn't cost anybody out of their pocket. And they needed the research so they could use it. Another book I sold for $300 a copy. These were great for me at the time because the royalties proved to be very, very successful. I mean, they didn't sell a lot of books, but they sold at such a high price that, you know, it still was profitable for me and the publisher. And I got to the point where publishers were seeking me out to write them. Instead of me having to go and pitch them on an idea, they came and said, hey, could you write a book on finances for non-financial marketers? And I said, I don't know anything about financing. And they said, exactly. You go to a couple of finance conferences. So, seriously, they wanted me to go to conferences, and whatever I could understand and put into a book, it would be like helpful to anybody else who didn't know what finance was all about. So I got an education, and I sold a book. That was another one that sold out the whole press run. Typically, they would run for 1,000 copies, and the publishers were thrilled to sell them all out. So that's how I got into it. And then the market kind of died because, you know, after I'd written 10 books on hospital marketing and some other people wrote their books on hospital marketing, it was no longer a big deal. When I started, it was brand new. 10 years later, it wasn't. So I moved on to other things.
You know, and that's who moved my cheese. And that's one thing you definitely have to be prepared for in this world. People who refuse to change, even companies, especially like even in the retail space, they didn't want to go online. They just didn't want those. I've seen big companies that were huge 30 years ago fold because they didn't want to change. So you got to see when the change is coming, you got to get ready to go with it, because if not, you could become history. You got to be willing to shift gears and see things are changing. So it's time for me to shift and change as well. That said, you've done hospital marketing, advertising, public relations. How you got started? You initially wanted to go in the military. You said you failed the eye test. And then you went into this space with the marketing, advertising, and that you had so much success, like with your book, Hospital Marketing, Step by Step, and the other books that you wrote. So I want to ask you now, just shifting gears a little bit here, is bloody, you didn't ever give up, it seems, your passion for the military. You never abandoned it. So that said, is Bloody Skies Over Bloody Ridge, is this your first novel, Ned?
No, that was, I wrote a series of 10 novels about 8 to 10 years ago that I published on Kindle directly, and that was one of those. My goal was to build, to create a series of maybe 15 novels and then publish them in print form in a series the way Webb Griffin does. You know, where you've got a single topic and you have the same characters kind of overlapping from book to book, but he covered in his series The Core, about the Marine Corps in World War II, you know, you follow a few characters through some major battles that the Marine Corps was in, and you get a real insight into what was going on there. I wanted to do that kind of thing, and I wrote the first 10 of them, and one of them was Bloody Skies Over Bloody Ridge, which is a fictional retelling of an actual air battle during the Battle of Guadalcanal. where three planes, that's all we could get off the ground. It was a real shoestring operation. But they stopped a Japanese attack that would have taken the airfield and ended the campaign as a failure, as a defeat. And it was really heroic. And because of the nature of the attack, two of the three planes were shot down. Their pilots survived. And the third one was all shot up, but it was able to get back to the airfield. Nonetheless, they were able to attack a huge mass of Japanese troops just as they were about to make a final assault on what became known as Bloody Ridge. They'd been assaulted all night, five or six different waves of attacks. And the Marine defenders were just about out of ammunition and got completely worn out, and they would have failed. But except for these three planes. And what they did was they put, you know, they did what fighter bombers do. They put the weapons on target, and the Japanese were forced to abandon the attack. And this happened. It happened just the way I described it. Only I used fictional characters, and you know, some of who had been in some of the other books in the series leading up to that battle. So that was one of them. But the series goes is Air War Pacific, and anybody goes to Kindle and looks me up, my name Ned Burnett, and then looks up Air War Pacific, they'll see all of them there. And some of them are long, some of them are short novellas or whatever. I took a specific battle, a specific incident, and told the whole story of it. And I didn't worry about the length. It was just however it came together. And I hope someday to return to that series and finish them, but right now that's just something that's sitting there in the background. I've talked to some people who helped me, and in the next year or two, I'm going to turn what I've got there into books, into printable books, print on demand, and sell them through Amazon as well. And I think I can revitalize them at that point. But they continue to sell, not spectacularly, but they continue to sell. Every month I get a check from Amazon. So I'm a happy person about those.
Okay. Now introduce us to the book's main characters. Who are some of the pilots and some of the other main characters in the series itself?
Okay. In the series itself, there's a combination of historical people who are there in the role they really played, but in a secondary capacity because I don't know them. And then there are primary characters who are fictionalized versions of those kinds of people. And one of them is a Marine dive bomber pilot, and I have him at Pearl Harbor on the morning of the attack. And in fact, there were some Marine dive bomber pilots there at the morning of the attack. And a few of them were actually airborne when the attack came in. They were on an early morning training mission. And while everybody, and I'm doing air quotes here, everybody knows that only Army Air Corps pilots got in the air and attacked the enemy because that's what they were supposed to do. In fact, these Marines were able to shoot down several Japanese planes. They just never got any credit because it wasn't the narrative. The narrative was the Army Air Force had 6 or 8, 10 pilots who actually got airborne, and they really outperformed the Japanese. So it was kind of like a, you know, we've just had a terrible loss, but isn't this neat? But to have a dive bomber pilot shoot down two planes, that's not what they wanted to hear. That wasn't the message they wanted to send, because it sounded too implausible. So they just never got any credit for it. But it really happened, so I tell that story. And then this dive bomber pilot, later he's at the Battle of Midway. And again, there were Marine dive bomber pilots at the Battle of Midway. And again, the conventional wisdom is that only the America's carrier-based airplanes did any damage to the Japanese fleet. But I found an official after-action report from the Marine Corps that said that one of these dive bomber pilots hit a Japanese carrier, the Kaga, with a 500-pound bomb. It didn't do a lot of damage, but they did hit it. That you don't find that in the history books, but I found it as archived official, you know, official report. So I told that story too. And then he went on to Guadalcanal, which was the first big offensive battle of the war, the first time we invaded an island and pushed the Japanese off of it. And so I follow all the what the dive bombers did by following this one character. So the audience gets to know who they are, who he is, and they care about him, and they follow him. And he does things that real dive bomber pilots did, It's just I'm using him as an archetypal character. I do the same thing with fighter pilots. I have two brothers who are both at Pearl Harbor when it was attacked. One's in the Army Air Corps and one's in the Navy. And they both get into the fighting in one way or another. And then you follow them through the later battles of 1942. And all my stories take place in late 41 or 1942 when we were overwhelmed, we were outnumbered, and we were not winning. We started out that war losing. The Japanese did tremendous success early in the war. And to me, when you're overwhelmed and fighting against an enemy that's got more combat experience than you do and has better planes than you have, it's a bit more heroic than when we had, 1,500 carrier planes flying over Japan in 1945. Yeah, it was still very dangerous, and I respect them a great deal. But when you're fighting for everything, and it's basically win or die, that's what I wanted to show, that the spirit of the Americans who are fighting against long odds and were able to defeat the Japanese despite all the advantages they had.
Now, I wanted to ask you, I think you sort of alluded to the answer to this question, but I definitely wanted to ask you, how much research, you're going back to the 1940s, how much research did you conduct and do you conduct while you're writing a military novel? Do you actually go visit some of these locations, or do you like pour through library books and TV film, and how much research do you do when you're actually putting the material together for the book?
That's a great question. I have in my personal library probably every book in print about Pearl Harbor, Midway, and Guadalcanal, and all
wow.
the other things that happened during that period of time. So I would read voraciously and make notes and things like that. And then I would do, in addition, I do internet research. And it was the internet where I found the documents that proved that these incidents happened, but the historians had overlooked or ignored because it didn't fit the message. And the message was set by people in the military early in World War II who were trying to overcome the great losses we experienced and to support the morale of the civilians who were, they wanted to hear about successes. So they said, oh, well, we only had a few pilots get off the ground, but they really, took care of the Japanese, so clearly we're ready to take them on. That would not have worked well if one of the pilots was flying a slow dive bomber, but still was able to be successful that way. It just didn't fit the meme, we'd call it today, so they didn't cover it. But the information is still there if you know where to look, and I would just become, extensively look at this and get what I needed. It was, so that's how I did it. And because I've been reading military history my whole life, I knew what to look for. I mean, I may have read something 40 years ago, and I don't know where I heard it, but I remembered something, so I went and looked for it and found it.
I had to ask you this. We've had other authors on, and they write historic novels, and there's a niche audience for that, and they love historic books, and it's a great way to learn, and it's just also entertaining and engaging. But I've had authors tell me they do extensive research, just like you said, all the books you've read, because I've had one writer said who was on Off the Shelf, if you say a certain type of food was served in a cafe, they use these certain type of napkins or whatever, she said that the readers who love historic fiction will tell you, oh, they didn't use those type of napkins then, or women didn't wear those type of shirts. Or the collars on the men's shirts weren't like that back then. So the research, the people, do you hear from readers who may say to you, oh, no, Ned, that wasn't how it went, or you got that right?
I have heard from both, and I always appreciate hearing from both. I always want to learn, and if I think I'm a good researcher, but I'm by no means infallible. And if I made a mistake, I want to know it so I can fix it. And one of the nice things about Kindle is that if you find a mistake, you can fix it for future buyers. So I always am on the lookout to learn more things. And new books keep coming out, and they may challenge some of my thoughts, and I can go back and fix things if I want to. Certainly I'll do that before I publish them in print form. I'm going to go through each one of them and do a final edit and make sure that everything is based on what I currently understand. And I just really enjoy it because I enjoy history. I enjoy the research. I minored in history in college, and I might have majored in it if there was any way to make a living doing it, but there wasn't. And I always intended my college education was going to give me a career. I wasn't a liberal arts major. I didn't want to just learn for learning's sake. There's nothing wrong with that, but I wanted a career. I knew I'd be out there working, and I'd rather work in something that I enjoyed and was trained for than get a job in sales, you know, for something I don't care about. It just wasn't what I wanted to do. So I love the research. I do feel voraciously. And because I've got so many books and I've read so many books, I knew where to start.
You know, I was going to ask you if history was a passion of yours, and indeed it is, because you've been on the History Channel several times. What were just like maybe two topics, because I have several other questions I wanted to ask you, but what were maybe like just two topics that you spoke about when you did appear on the History Channel?
Okay, sure. I appeared on 9 History Channel programs. Most of them were modern marvels, and they were about technology, military technology. And the two that are, the two that are most interesting to me, one was called Submarine Disasters, and it was about submarines that sank, not in wartime, but because there was some flaw in the sub and they sank. And so I researched that, and I put together an hour program on that subject. What thrilled me was that two of the people that we interviewed for the program were Tom Clancy and Clive Cussler, who both write naval-related fiction, and I was passionate fans of both. Unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to go and meet them. They filmed them at where they lived. Our crew went there to film where they were. But in the final edit, it looked like I was talking to them. So I was very thrilled to be on the same place as these two gentlemen, because they were role models for what I'd like to write. And the other one was on World War I technology. And so I shot this, and the studio I worked with, they were doing so much work at that time. They were in overcrowded facilities. They'd taken a storage closet and converted it into a little set. And it looked like I was in one of the trenches in World War I. And it was just, you know, boxes with camouflage netting stretched over it and all this kind of stuff. But the room, with the TV lights in there, it was over 100 degrees. And it had no air conditioning because it was a closet. And it was just really a challenge. But here's what was so cool, is the last survivor who had fought in the trenches during World War I, he was 106 years old. He lied about his age and got into combat at age 16. He was now 106 years old, and we interviewed him for that program. And unfortunately, he died before the show came out. But we were able to capture that element of history, that moment of I was there. And he was fascinating. He was still sharp. He was lucid. He understood what he was saying. He remembered things. It was remarkable. And I have a great degree of respect for any veteran from any side of any war. Because people, whether they're fighting for our side or the other side, they were fighting for their country. They were fighting for their family and their friends. And, you know, they were willing to lay down their lives for their family, for their friends, for their country. And that's an honorable thing. So I love getting to know these people and talking to them. This guy was just absolutely remarkable. And I felt really honored that I was able to be on that program with him. So those are the two.
Wow. Oh, my goodness. What a life. What a life, Ned, so far. And your journey continues. And I thank you again for being here on Off the Shelf with us. As we come down to the last 10 minutes of today's show, I want to switch gears again and ask you, when did you launch Barnett Marketing?
Barnett Marketing, I launched that in late 1985 under a different name. It was I had a business partner at the time, so it was BNW Healthcare Marketing Communications. But that business ended, and I guess kept going as an independent consultant. I've had several other businesses, but Barnett Marketing as it is now since 1994, when and it took the name because it was a name that was available as a URL. So it had been Barnett Associates, but that was taken by a company in Holland. So I had to come up with a different name. So I named a business based on what I created a website on. But it's been going since 1985. So I guess about 35 years.
Wow. Oh, my goodness. What are some of the services that you offer who is your audience? Are writers a part of your audience? And what are some of the services that you offer through your marketing firm?
Okay, well, first and foremost, we are I have an author service company. And what I do is find out what authors need at whatever level that they are at and help them with that. So if they don't have a book, I help them write a book, or I ghostwrite it for them. If they've got a book and it hasn't been edited, I get it professionally edited. I either do it myself or bring somebody in, depending on the type of book it is. Then if they have it edited but not published, I'll help them self-publish it or find a publisher. Although for most startup authors, that's no longer the attractive option it used to be. We get no advances to speak of, and they take most of the money. And you still have to do the marketing, so you're going to take most of the money yourself. So I help people self-publish. And then that's when I get into marketing and promotion. And again, it depends on what they need. Some people want me to do it all for them. Other people want me to coach them. So I've got clients right now where I coach them on what they're doing, and I guide them, and then they do it based on what I've shown them. Others where I'm doing it all. They just, they'll show up for a radio interview, but that's about it. They want me to do it because that's not their field, and they know that it's not, and they want to do that. And in fact, one of the books that I'm going to have published 4 new books in the coming year, and one of them is going to be a book about marketing and promoting your book. So I'll be putting all this out there. I mean, I've done blogs on this and write columns and articles for a variety of publications on how to do this. But I'm taking everything I've learned in 35 years of doing this and putting it into a book, and it's in the final editing process right now. So it'll be coming out in, I hope, in the spring.
Okay. Can you share 3 or 4 steps that you've taken? You've gone hospital marketing, your history, your nonfiction books. You've written 39 and published 39 books, and then you still have 4 more now in the works. But can you share 3 to 4 steps that you've taken there that you found to be effective firsthand, not just something you've heard about, but you've used and you found it to be effective at getting the word out about your books?
Sure. First of all, what I talked about earlier was the creating the virtual platform. As far as I've been able to tell, nobody else was doing that when I first started doing it. That may be, but I've never been able to find them if they were. And that is hugely powerful in building a fan base quickly. You have to be very careful about that because these groups are, they have one strike and you're out. You're not allowed to self-promote. You can talk about what you know, but you have to do a two-step process. If you want to promote your book, you have to write a blog about it on your website and then invite people to come see the blog. And when they do, that's when they find out about the book and can be encouraged to buy it. So that is one thing that I really, really like to do. Another thing I think is very powerful is creating short YouTube videos about the book and the author and the writing life and process. If people like a book you've written, they're going to want to know how you did it as a writer. And this is a chance where you can talk one-on-one with your fans and let them know how you did what you did. And that enriches their experience. And whenever you do that, you're going to build more fans. You're going to word of mouth. So that is another really important and really powerful thing I've done. A third thing I've discovered is while email is useful for many things, if you want to set up a reading event at a bookstore or a museum or something like that, you have got to go in person and meet face-to-face with the people. I had a client earlier this year. He'd written a great book but the publisher did nothing for it. So I helped him take it back from the publisher and republish it as a self-published book. Then, because it was upon about a nuclear disaster at the Nevada test site in 1970 that the government hushed up, but 86 people were exposed to deadly radiation, and he was the attorney representing them, and that's what his book was about. I had written to there's a Smithsonian Museum here in town in Las Vegas that is the National Atomic Testing Museum. Great place. And Smithsonian, it doesn't get any more credible than that. I'd written them several emails and never heard back from them. So I called up the client and said, Larry, meet me in their parking lot at 10 o'clock and bring some books. So we walked into the gift shop, and I said, excuse me, who buys product for you? This one woman stepped up and said, I do. Why? And I showed her the book and said, this is the author of this book, and we'd like to see about placing the book in your bookstore. And I'd like to see about having him speak at a conference that you have. They hold several conferences throughout the year. She took one look at it and says, yes, I'll take 25 copies.
Wow. And
then the director of the museum contacted us and said, I heard all about what you're doing. Larry, we want you to come and give the first of a series of presentations in 2020. So he'll be going in and they'll promote it. There'll be a big crowd of people there at the museum, and he'll be talking about his book, and they'll be signing the book and, selling it. Well, the museum will sell it. He'll get the royalties, but he won't be, doing the selling himself. But he'll take the books and autograph them personally. Now, all the books that we have at the museum, and this is something, again, this is something all authors need to know about. They're all autographed. That makes them more valuable to people who buy. There are some people that just really love to have books signed by their authors. It makes them feel important or whatever it makes them feel. So always, if you're selling a book, autograph it. Always. If you're giving it to a bookstore, as we did with the museum bookstore there, we give them 25 copies. They're all autographed. So they can promote it as autographed by the author. And that helps them sell. And one of the things we did with it, we're set up now to be able to deliver the books as any publisher would. But the first batch of books they sold, they said, we want to sell them on consignment to see if it sells. And so we said, fine. And Larry had the copies. He brought them by. And as they sell them, they pay us for them. And when they get to a lower level, they renew it. But it was the way to go for them, because that way they didn't have any financial risk.
Right.
We were confident the book, if they got the book, they would sell. One of the things they told us, the person who took the books, says, we have an exhibit about this incident. So they actually had something in the museum about that. So it was a natural tie-in for them. So again, but they'd ignored all my emails, which I thought were good, persuasive selling emails, but show up in person and they couldn't be any nicer. And I've had lots of experiences like that, but that was just the most clear cut of not getting any traction with email or phone calls. But you show up in person, you become a real person to them, and boom, there you go. So those are some lessons that I found that are very effective across the board.
Yeah, getting out in person, even with the internet, I used to hit the road. Or when I hit the road, my book sales would spike. There's something about being at an event in person. It online alone, you could be successful online alone, but I think it's a good way to get a lot of quick uptick is to go to a large event or an event effective around your book in person. Now, where can off the shelf listeners get copies of your books, Ned?
Okay, the books that are currently available, a number of them I wrote before the internet, so they're no longer in print and not available. But if you go to Amazon and search my name, you'll find all the books that I have in print now. And in the coming year, I'm going to do 4 new books. And one of them is a science fiction romance. One of them is a book on how to market your book. A third is a murder mystery that I'm very excited about. It's what I'm passionate about. And the fourth is a book on the history of race and politics in America. I grew up in the South during the civil rights era. I worked with lots of groups in helping to earn equal rights for everybody, I help, for instance, desegregate the Methodist Church in Georgia. And it's always been a passion of mine. And for a number of years, my son, who's a college professor, taught at a historically black college, and I knew that I had done something right in raising him so that he was comfortable in that role and was accepted in that role because of who he is. So it's been something that I've always been passionate about, and I wanted to get out there, and I basically found a patron who agreed. He's not a writer, but he'd like to see that get out. And so that's on the front burner for this year as well.
Okay. Now, can you tell us if you're on any social media platforms where our off-the-shelf listeners can find you online?
Yes, you can find me on Facebook, Ned Barnett. I think there are three Ned Barnetts in this country. I'm the one that's in Las Vegas and is the writer. There's a newspaper man in North Carolina and a slip and fall attorney in Dallas. I'm not either one of those. But you can find me on Facebook, and that's probably the best way. I do some stuff on Twitter, but I'm not real active unless I've got a client that needs to be there. But I do an awful lot on Facebook.
Okay. We have had the absolute pleasure of speaking with Ned Barnett today. He has actually, you guys, published more than 39 books, and including nonfiction and fiction, and some of his titles are State of the Art in Hospital Advertising and Hospital Marketing, Step by Step, Bloody Skies of a Bloody Ridge. That's a series, First Shot, and Lafayette, We Are Here. Encourage you to visit Ned online at barnettmarcom.com. That's BARNETTMARCOM.com. Thank you, Ned, for being here with us, and thank you to each of our listeners. Please come back here next Saturday, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and we will have another great guest on deck for you. And remember, you are awesome. You are amazing. You are incredible. Go out and create a fabulous day for yourself. Ned, I'll shoot you an email. Bye for now.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye.